Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Maddie.
And...
Steve.
Hang on a second. So, the more observant of our subscribers will notice that Maddie is not Ben and Steve is not Laura. So what? Who are you and what are you doing here?
I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Bristol and I'm working between chemistry and engineering on tissue engineering scaffold. We want to try and make some kind of architecture that we could hopefully grow fake organs.
Cool, that seems very useful. What are you doing, Steve?
I'm a teaching fellow in the Faculty of Engineering at the University of Bristol. I'm also finishing off a PhD in Aerospace Dynamics and Control.
Which is good news, because today's episode is all about The Martian. But what does that mean you actually do all day?
Mostly make giant robots pretend to be aeroplanes.
Okay, that seems fair.
We're modelling the way that aircraft moves so we can test sensors to make aircraft fly better.
Can you do that for spaceships as well, please?
Yes.
Oh, good. Thanks. That's great news. So, Steve, you're no stranger to the Cosmic Shed. The reason you're here, the reason we know you, is because you won a competition.
I did, and I was so excited.
So, Steve won our Apollo 13 competition. How much coffee did you win?
All the coffee. I won two bags of the most amazing coffee that I have ever drunk.
And you're not just saying that because the Cosmic Shed is supported by Slow Brew Club Coffee.
I'm actually not. They're really lovely. They come in amazing bags. I opened it and I was blown away by the smell, and then I ground it and drank it and was really happy.
But you have a link to the Cosmic Shed as well, Maddie, because you work with Bruce Drinkwater.
Yes, I do.
Previous guest on the Cosmic Shed, the man who invented a sonic screwdriver.
Yeah, that's pretty cool really, isn't it?
So I think basically... if you can work with Bruce on inventing stuff from sci-fi, and Steve, if you can improve spaceships, then this is a good shed. Ben, who you'll know from the Cosmic Shed, is currently living in Ningbo, China. And Laura, who you'll know from the Cosmic Shed, is currently living in Winchester.
Slightly more convenient, but not very conducive to... shed access.
No, quite. So this is the Cosmic Shed. Welcome, you guys. It's lovely to have you here. So The Martian is the film which, if you haven't heard about it, it's a bit ridiculous. You've not been out of the house. You've not seen a bus. You've not looked on the internet. Everybody knows what The Martian is. It's the film based on the book by Andy Weir. We have an episode already about the book. This is the episode about the film. There will be spoilers in this episode.
Many spoilers.
But I do think you could know everything, just like the book, you could know pretty much everything about this film, and it's still amazing to go and see it. So don't worry, if you've not seen the film, you are an idiot, but there is still time to go and see it.
Pause this now. Go and watch The Martian. Pause this podcast. Come back. But pause it and go and watch it.
Yeah.
Or just listen, because we read the book and we loved the book and we love the film. I think it's one of the few films where the film is as good as the book. Different, but as good.
Could not agree more. But have either of you written a poem?
No.
Not even a rhyming couplet?
Well, it's a good job we've got the internet then. Let's try and contact Ben in Ningbo, China, and see if he's written a poem.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
What are you doing in China, Ben?
Well, apparently I'm avoiding watching The Martian.
Has it not been released?
There is a release date now. 26th of November it's coming out. which is a ways away. It's a bit frustrating. But thankfully, it's really easy to be on information lockdown. Google services, Twitter, Facebook are all blocked over here. So unless I try, I could easily avoid all mention of the amazing changes they made to the film. The monsters they added, the unhappy ending where Mark bites it.
I'm saying nothing. And clearly you're not going to listen to this episode of The Cosmic Shed before November the 26th.
I think I might have to, if I'm going to do the editing.
So, Ben, have you written a poem?
Yes. Andrew, this episode, asked me to write a poem about my experience of being in China while The Martian is showing in other countries. For once, I actually tried to do what he suggested. For this poem, I found a form which I'm going to try and pronounce. Liu Shi. So Liu Shi is a traditional form of Chinese poetry, 8 lines long, and they can be 5, 6, or 7 words. Each line should be the same length. And the even lines should rhyme. And the middle 2 couplets should have some form of parallelism. Though my world is red and stars, I would never compare myself to Mark. For one thing, I can't grow potatoes, and nights here are much less dark. Plus, my computer holds more than disco. The landscape is not quite as stark. I only have to wait 42 days, not 549 souls, until I can depart.
Thanks, Ben. We need to find something that you can watch in China and do an episode about that. Thanks, bye!
Bye!
So, The Martian, Ridley Scott. Can we start by saying this is considerably better than Ridley Scott's last space film?
Prometheus?
Yeah.
I never watched it.
Had such bad reviews.
didn't bother.
Didn't go anywhere near it.
Sorry, yeah. Ridley.
Yeah. That's okay. He's made up for it now.
Definitely.
Yeah, we all pretty much loved it, didn't we?
The visuals in the film get it across so well. I'll say, if you haven't seen it yet, or if you want to see it again, go and see it on as big a screen as possible.
Yeah.
See it in 3D. It's one of the few films that I would recommend definitely seeing in 3D if you can.
I love the way that the emotions so juxtaposed. I cried a little bit, and then I laughed straight away afterwards. It was just so beautifully done.
Yeah, there's that complete isolation and desolation, but still the ability to find humour in it that makes his character so compelling, isn't it? And that's come direct from the book.
I think Matt Damon is perfectly cast in this. I vary on my Matt Damon fanness, but he's really, really good in this. And just the sounds are amazing. The soundtrack is amazing, yeah. Apart from the disco.
But completely that disco adds to that, exactly what you're saying. That
such a juxtaposition.
Yeah, yeah. Of the predicament and sort of upbeat song. My favourite part of the movie was when Matt Damon's spacesuit got ruptured, the helmet got smashed in, and he had, like, I think, was it something ridiculously low? Like 10 or 15 seconds?
Yeah.
And instead of trying to trudge back across into the safety of the space station, he just grabbed some duct tape and started taping up his helmet. Yes, of course duct tape works in a near vacuum. Duct tape works anywhere. Duct tape is magic and should be worshipped.
That's a quote from the book.
That's something that comes up in the book quite. You've not read the book, have you?
No, I haven't.
Or listened to the audiobook, which is available now with audibletrial.com/The Cosmic Shed.
Get on it.
That's how I got hold of it, and I loved it. The guy that narrates it is R.C. Bray, and he's fantastic.
I loved the book so much, and the film just doesn't disappoint. Mm. I imagine it's entirely possible to watch the film and then go back and read the book and not have lost very much.
I think it'll add to your experience of the film. There's a couple of bits the film skipped that I really liked. There's the bit where he bricked Pathfinder.
There's the moment where Mark Watney discovers that what he says is being broadcast around the world. And in the film, it's artfully left out.
Yes.
But in the book, he says...
In the book where he types, "Look!" exclamation mark. "A pair of boobs!" exclamation mark. Right arrow, open bracket, full stop, capital Y, full stop, close bracket.
So now you know.
Scientific boobs ever.
The thing that I really love all through the book, all through the movie, is the problem solving. It fascinates me to be able to see Mark Watney's thought process. The film has less technical detail in it than the book, but you see enough of Watney's thought process to be really impressed. I hope that the film will encourage more people into engineering and science or even botany. But yeah, I am exactly the type of person that the XKCD comic is about. This is Randall Munroe's comic about the Martian on XKCD.com, as read by Andrew and Maddie.
Ooh, the trailer for The Martian!
What's that, Andrew?
Oh, it's the movie of a book I liked.
Should I read it?
It depends. You know the scene in Apollo 13 where the guy says, "We have to figure out how to connect this thing to this thing using this table full of parts, or the astronauts will all die"?
Yeah.
Well, The Martian is for people who wish the whole movie had been just more of that scene.
How on earth did that become a big budget thing with Matt Damon?
No idea, but I'm so excited! I've just realised that's not me acting.
That's why you were cast for that role.
And then here's a reason to read the book. This rollover text on the comic only applies to the book, but it says, "I've never seen a work of fiction so perfectly capture the out-of-nowhere shock of discovering that you've just bricked something important because you didn't pay enough attention to a loose wire. I have done that so many times in my life and in my PhD."
A joint favourite part of the movie, of mine and Steve's, was when
Rich Purnell, the steely-eyed missile man,
came in with his top secret project, which he called Project Elrond. And who else was in at the boardroom meeting? None other than Sean Bean.
I was really expecting Sean Bean to break the fourth wall and just look straight into camera at that point. Yeah. It was like, yes, this is why I'm in this movie.
There must be a few outtakes ready, doesn't The Rich Purnell manoeuvre. Rich Purnell's done all the equations on his board, on his blackboard, and then for some reason he's written science exclamation mark on his board. It's really, really complex bit of...
dynamics.
Yeah, orbital dynamics. Hermes is going round the Earth, and they've got to launch a rocket to intercept with it. They're speeding up quite dramatically as they slingshot round the Earth. And at the same time, they've got to launch a rocket with supplies to get to... that's pretty tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is crazy, crazy problems, which is why you need supercomputers to solve them. You can use Kepler and Newton's, all their different theories to plot very easily the forces between two things. But as soon as you've got three, stuff gets a bit mental and chaotic. And small changes at one point in orbit can have massive changes later on. And it's really counterintuitive. You have to speed up to go lower and slow down to get higher, and if you push in one direction, you might go in another, stuff like that.
In a way, it's a spoiler to list anybody else who's in the film, because it suggests that maybe there might be some other people who come and save him. In the book, I think it's like the first eight chapters of the book, you don't hear from anyone else.
Something popped up on my Facebook about how much the American government in movies has spent rescuing Matt Damon in the last few years. We could do The Martian now if there was the political will.
Yeah.
You strand Matt Damon on Mars.
Which I think there is.
Well, he knows what to do now.
So is that true? We could actually do... We could send manned crews to Mars... Not today, but in the very near future.
And please correct me if I'm wrong on Twitter or something, but I don't think there was any technology in The Martian that does not exist today, or we could not build today with currently known science.
Okay, so why aren't we?
Good question, because space is awesome. We know that. We would do. It's money. There's stuff on Earth that needs money spending on it. There's lots of stuff on Earth that maybe we shouldn't be worrying about spending money on. And the benefits to going to Mars are beyond the current sort of political and economic cycles that drive the world. If this was back in the Cold War, then we'd be throwing all our money at it because there was obvious political benefits to showing you've got a bigger rocket than the other country.
Quite literally.
But we're getting to a place where people are doing that, and there's private companies now sending things into space. You've got SpaceX, Planetary Resources are looking at mining asteroids, which is just next level sci-fi craziness to me. So we're moving back into another space age. It's coming slowly. The future is here, but just not evenly distributed yet. William Gibson. Yeah. It's a very exciting time to be alive. And if you look at the progression of space technology and progress in the long term, there's kind of a steady increase in what we're doing, and the Cold War was kind of a blip. And if you look at the trajectory minus the Cold War, then things are happening, just slightly slower. It feels like things aren't as exciting as back then because we haven't got people any further than low Earth orbit. There's organisations planning it. NASA has plans for people on Mars. Other countries do. Private organisations do.
Real private organisations have plans for people on Mars?
Yes. Elon Musk wants to retire to Mars.
Okay.
He made a lot of money out of PayPal and other ventures. He is now spending it on things that he thinks benefit humanity. So he's trying to stop global warming by making electric cars and solar cells and associated stuff. And he's trying to back us up by moving us to a different planet. He wants to put 1 million people on Mars. That's what he thinks you need for a sort of sustainable society there. Obviously, that's a long-term goal.
Yeah. Is that 1 million people from Earth to Mars, or sort of 500,000, and they create more when they get there?
I don't know, because, yeah, it'd be fairly easy to grow them once you get there, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We've been doing it for a while.
Yes, we're good at that.
almost too good.
You're not supposed to know about that. Big government secrets revealed.
I thought you were a bit vague about what your science you were doing earlier.
There's an amazing series of blog posts by a chap called Tim Urban, who has a website called Wait But Why. And one of them is titled Elon Musk, the World's Raddest Man. You should definitely read it.
I can't imagine the impetus being there for a private company to go to Mars. This statistics that for every dollar that NASA puts into space exploration, the American economy gets $8 back, or somewhere between 8 and 14, depending on where you plot it from. But I can't see that necessarily working with a private company.
Yeah. So SpaceX at the moment is making money, I don't know if they're profitable yet, but they're making money out of launching satellites. And all of the tech that you need to get to Mars is also valuable commercially for communications and spy satellites and things like that. It's longer term, it's valuable to humanity if you view it in that way. A backup of the human race is something that some people would think is a good idea.
It's not a major point of the movie, but they do sort. You do see the kind of organisational side of things, like when they're discussing, we need to check if he's alive on the satellite feed, obviously because it's public, they don't want to show a dead astronaut and have that all over the newspapers.
Yep.
So you're sort of sat in this kind of ethical, political dilemma.
Teddy Sanders, played by Jeff Daniels, gets things across really, really well. He talks about the media side of it, the potential funding impact of the world seeing a dead body on Mars. And then we get, if we imply that the next mission is going to bring him back, they're going to throw money at us.
Yeah.
But we need to do it now, because next year everyone will be bored of it.
Media has a massive influence on everything, all the big decisions, because you don't want to come across badly, particularly an organisation like NASA.
And then when Jeff Daniels is telling Sean Bean off later in the film, he's the director of NASA for a reason. He's got the long-term view. He says, I'm trying to keep us flying. There's more at stake here than one man's life.
It is bigger than one man's life, but wherever we are in the world, society will look after that one person who's stranded on a mountain, in a river. The one person in peril, we all come together to help them.
And it's a person, not a statistic, because there's so much stuff that goes on all over the world, and in some ways you can't process it all.
That's one of the things that I love about this film and the book, is the way that the whole of humanity comes together. It's the Apollo 13 thing, where they're on the spaceship and there's a group of engineers and scientists in a room who work out how to get them home. This is the whole planet, in a way, that's rooting for him coming together. There's all the guys at NASA. There's everybody at NASA.
Everybody watching.
And then there's the discussion that they have at the Chinese Space Agency when we first see it. When
again, political.
Yes. And they say, well, if we don't help him, no one will know that we could. But they do, because they're scientists. And they say we need this to be a discussion between scientists, not politicians.
Yeah. Do you think they're going to cut that bit out for Ben's version of it in China?
Ooh, interesting.
But then how will the movie flow?
It probably won't. I don't suppose they care.
They just won't show it.
Yeah.
Got to be a bit careful here, haven't we?
I don't know. People probably can't access the podcast in China.
I was going to say, is the Cosmic Shed available in China?
I don't know. Let's ask Ben. I am struggling really hard to find anything to complain about or that I didn't enjoy about the film. It really hard push. When we came out from the film, and I think it was Maddie who said... about the love interest.
Because it was so subtle. Like, they just kind of looked at each other, and then she, like, kissed his helmet, and then they had a baby.
Hang on. Let's move on quickly before that.
They didn't have a baby in space.
No. Do you think that anyone has had sex on the International Space Station?
How would that work?
Have you not seen Chris Hadfield's video?
Oh my god, that would sell so much. You know what? He's a very sexy man.
But
oh my
speaking
god.
About wow. space sex, there's a series which was
Space X or Space Sex?
Both. There's a series which was cancelled after one series for quite good reason, called Defying Gravity. The idea of people enjoying each other's company in space is covered quite comprehensively in that series. It's
great euphemism, Andrew.
Very much enjoyed your company in space. Aside from that love interest, which didn't really add a whole lot to the story, I felt that once he'd returned to Earth, major spoiler, sorry everyone, I would have quite liked to see a bit of his kind of adapting back into Earth life, having been by himself for so long.
Okay.
And having to deal with all that.
That's The Martian 2. I like the nod to Neil Armstrong, that when he comes back he becomes a lecturer. I like that.
I didn't not like anything about it. All of the sort of science compromises they made were, again, logical for films. If I was going to nitpick, there's two things that sort of struck me as stuff that might have been more scientifically accurate without any changes to the movie. Actually, one would be difficult. So there's a lot of radiation on the surface of Mars. There's not a lot of atmosphere to absorb stuff. I think Andy Weir was asked that in a question, and he says something like, well, in this universe, the hab is made of a magic radiation-blocking material that we don't have.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And the other one is, if you look at hydrazine wrong, then you die. Yeah, hydrazine is nasty, and they have to basically fully suit up when they fuel up spaceships and things like that.
But there's a very good reason why he's not suited up for that scene, and that is it is totally hilarious when he blows himself.
Both of those are massively nitpicky. I don't care about them at all. The bits that weren't included from the book, there's obvious logical reasons why they did that. 10-hour audiobook down to 2-hour movie. The missions appear very well designed. They do the logical thing that I think is in NASA's plans for getting there, of sending stuff up before they send people up. The return vehicles, what do they call them? The MAV, the Mars Ascent Vehicles, are there in advance. There's ideas about how you generate fuel without having to take all your fuel for the return journey all the way to Mars. And that's fairly easy. If you can get to the ice at Mars caps, you can break it down into oxygen and hydrogen, and you've got fuel. I think they're talking about doing that on the moon as well.
Is that the best way to get around the solar system, to go to the moon first and then create a moon station where we can then use what's on the moon to blast off towards Mars?
I haven't done the maths, but...
Well, could you, please?
give me a few hours and I can do it. But I would imagine that getting away from the moon uses a lot less fuel than getting away from the Earth. Getting away from the moon and the Earth's gravity well that the moon is in would be easier than getting from the surface of the Earth. There's no gravity in interplanetary space. Very little gravity in interstellar space. And when you're moving through space at the same rate as your surrounding spaceship, then you are effectively weightless.
And yet in the film, people are walking around in part of the space.
In
right?
part of it. And you see them go from the central part of the spaceship where there is no gravity, and then they slide down the ladder into the ring. And that's brilliant. It's very 2001, isn't it? You can do that by centripetal acceleration, centrifugal, depending on your reference frame. The rotation of the ring that's part of Hermes creates what feels to the astronauts like a gravitational force that holds them to the floor. We already know that astronauts suffer degradation of their bones and other parts of their body when they spend a long time on the International Space Station. And that's a concern, because going to Mars would take a long time. We don't realise it. We're working out all the time here, holding ourselves up against the Earth's gravity. So if you take that away, then your muscles and bones don't get what they need.
We've got to Mars using our rotating spaceship, and when he's there, he uses Pathfinder. What is Pathfinder?
Pathfinder was a lander sent to Mars, which landed in 1997 and contained a rover called Sojourner. And this was designed to last for 7 sols, but exceeded all expectations and lasted for 83. Do they underestimate so that it looks so much better?
Yeah.
Or are they just being really conservative?
I would probably phrase it the other way around. They don't underestimate, but they design it so that they don't look bad when it fails 3 days into its 7-day mission. Because everything has a probability of failure, and you want to minimise that. And I mean, it's impossible to eliminate any chance of failure. We know that because from one of the Mars landers that crashed into the surface. I heard that was because they got their units wrong. Someone was using metres and someone was using feet. Yeah. I don't know if that's actually the case, but it's funny enough that it gets repeated.
Yeah.
Like the Russians using a pencil. They design them for sort of worst case situations, and if they don't encounter the nasty sharp dust or the big heavy landing or whatever, then they'll last longer. The fact that there are photos of robots taken by other robots on another planet just blows my mind.
Yeah.
Do we need to send humans into space? Because for a lot of things that we want to find out about space, robots are better.
Mm.
They don't need food, they don't need water, they're not squishy. But they can only sense what we have designed them to sense. People are great at problem solving, which is one of the things I said I loved. Mark Watney is so creative in his solutions.
If there was somebody on Mars now and we found the water...
The news that NASA's research suggests Mars has at least a small amount of liquid water.
It's nowhere near any of the rovers that we can currently send to it because they don't move far enough. But a human on Mars could go to that bit and look at it in real time for us now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we've discovered that from an orbiter, an orbiting robot, if you like, and the robots on Mars can't get there. But if it was a human, it'd be much easier for them to travel to that spot, and we can find out things much quicker than you can with robotic mission.
And the reason that NASA believes there's water on Mars is because of what they've inferred from other measurements that they've taken. So they've looked at the wavelengths being reflected by those streaky smears that they see, and have determined that they're salty, and that's their only possible explanation is that there's stuff dissolved in water. That's what it looks like. But if there was a person there, they could go and stick the finger in it and feel it and taste it and smell it and distill it and check its water and do all this other stuff.
So what have they found?
I could answer that, but I know someone that can probably do it a lot better than me.
It's been known for a long time that there's lots of water on Mars. There's obvious fluvial features. There is a lot of water ice. One of the polar caps is made of water ice. You can see water ice in the atmosphere floating around. And so it's not surprising that there is water, at least in ice form.
I managed to catch up with Dr. Elliot Sefton-Nash from the University College London Birkbeck Centre for Planetary Sciences.
The recent headline about these new gullies being formed, they're actually called recurring slope lineae. Gullies are slightly larger, but these lineae are these kind of small dark patches that form seasonally in the walls of craters. And the idea with those is that no one really knew how they were forming. You could see them occurring and then disappearing seasonally, but nobody had been able to prove what they were formed by. And there were lots of hypotheses. There were, you know, there might have been CO2, liquid CO2 melting, because CO2 ice can exist in the Mars regolith. And so then it might suddenly melt and cause some slurry. It could have been some other effect. It could have been a wind-blown kind of, you know, like a small sandy avalanche forming these things. But it turns out this headline was because of measurements by a spectrometer, which detected hydrated salts on these features, precisely where they were. And that signature disappeared when the features disappeared. So, and that was used as evidence to say that they're definitely formed by a brine, a salty water that flows out of the crater wall seasonally and then disappears. And so that's pretty convincing evidence to me that there is, you know, there's ice on the subsurface in these places, and it's seasonally recharging the surface. So in a way, it's a big result. A lot of people suspected this for a while, but I think we're all quite happy that it's now been proven. Personally, my job is In a nutshell, I analyse data that is returned from spacecraft out in the solar system. In my current position, I'm actually working on the ExoMars rover, which should be launched in 2018. This is a rover, the first Mars rover by the European Space Agency. And it's a first for a number of reasons, not only that it's the first Mars rover by ESA, but it's also the first rover to have a radar on it, a ground-penetrating radar, which means it's going to look at the structure of the subsurface, which no rover has really done so far. It's also got a drill that can penetrate to about 2 meters or so. And so the combination of instruments and this drill means that we're really looking into the subsurface where some of these ices might still be stable. And so for that reason, it's quite an exciting mission. And I've been working on the landing sites. There's a long drawn out process for selecting the best landing site for this rover. And there's a whole selection process that goes on to choose where the best place is to send it and where the safest place to send it is. The whole process is quite ongoing and quite fluid because it has to be a balance between scientific interest and engineering safety. And there's constant battles between scientists and engineers, as I'm sure happens all over the world. But in this case, it can become quite heated. But ultimately, everybody's working towards the same goal. So hopefully we'll end up with a great site and there'll be a good potential for discovering something very interesting. I have seen The Martian. I thought it was actually quite refreshing. It was a bit of a steer away from a lot of the sensationalist, just scientifically ridiculous kind of sci-fi films that have come out. There was a particular line that Matt Damon said, I think right at the end of the film, when he's preaching to these astronaut candidates who have just entered some academy and they're sitting around and, you know, listening to his wise words. And he says something like, survival is just solving a series of problems. And if you solve enough problems one at a time, you eventually get to the right answer or you survive. And that's largely how science works. It might be slow moving sometimes, but you make big discoveries by slow incremental progress. I quite like that. That was the sentiment that I really took home from the film. Because that was largely based around my field, you know, and so it depicted a lot of what goes on. There are obviously some differences between the way that NASA was run and reality, but, you know, largely that's kind of, it was a nice insight. It was a closer insight to the reality of how a space agency works than any other film I know of. I did quite like the engineers always having this catchphrase, I've run the numbers. I kind of like using that in everyday life. That is kind of how it works. You can't argue with data. If you've got good data and good statistics, then that's how discoveries get made. I think this has been voiced by some other people too. I've heard it mentioned, probably more in my office than anywhere else. When his habitat depressurizes because he basically blows up his potato nursery, and the door blows out and he loses atmospheric pressure, but then he seals it with this kind of plastic sheeting, and it's kind of like a floppy tarpaulin, but to make it worse, he just tapes it on with gaffer tape, and that's kind of probably not going to work. The difference between the inside pressure, which is going to be one bar, one atmosphere, which it has to be, and the atmospheric pressure on the surface of Mars, the difference is almost one atmosphere. The surface pressure on Mars is about 6 millibars. So, you know, it's less than 1%, which means that you would have this huge pressure differential and essentially this plastic sheeting wouldn't cut it. And you could see it kind of flapping around in the supposed wind outside, but it would be bulging, it would be bursting at the seams because the atmospheric the pressure on the inside would almost certainly blow it out. And gaffer tape, sadly, as much as we all trust gaffer tape, I don't think it would do the job in this case. They did make it quite dramatic. The dust storm, I think, was probably a lot more dangerous than it would be. I would expect they wouldn't have to abandon a mission because of a dust storm. The issue is that you could see large pebbles being saltated or lifted up and bounced around the surface. And that probably wouldn't happen. The largest thing that gets moved by wind on Mars is small sand grains. And it's certainly not as dangerous as they depicted. It wouldn't push over a large rocket that's landed. The winds are fast, but the air is so thin that the net result is not that dangerous, I would think.
If you had the opportunity, would you go to Mars?
I would be apprehensive, frankly, at the moment, mostly because I've met a lot of people that work in human spaceflight, and it's very difficult. There's a lot of big challenges, and we're getting there slowly. There's a lot of things to do with interplanetary travel, especially, that are pretty dangerous to humans. Protecting yourself against solar flares, the long-term physiological effects of low gravity, things like that. I just think it's a little bit too dangerous. I think if I was older, I might have a different opinion. If I'd already had kids and maybe I was, you know, 50 or something, I'd be more keen. But at this point, there's too much to lose, I think.
If your HAB iPod had broken, assuming you'd retired to Mars, what album would you most like to have if it was the only album you had on loop for 4 years?
Wow, this is like an extreme Desert Island Discs. I think I would have to go for, this might sound a bit weird, I think I would go for something like, something that was sampled, possibly DJ Shadow? Maybe his first album, Introducing, something like that. And the main reason is that it's got samples from so many other different genres that you actually, in one album, you can get quite a lot of different reminders of what music is. You know, if I was stuck with one album, it's got to be comprehensive. And also, it's, you know, it's quite rhythmically heavy, and I play the drums, so I'm a huge fan of that. I play in a band called Joy Shop. We have three albums available from all good electronic music stores. We play kind of folk pop, and there's lots of influences there. There's kind of jazz, there's a bit of funk, there's stuff like that. So if you're into your folk pop or indeed any of the jazz or funk, check out Joy Shop.
It's a bit cold in the Cosmic Shed, Andrew.
I know.
Did you bring the RTG?
I think you probably need to explain what that is, Steve.
Oh, what's the film? The RTG features in the book and the film. An RTG is a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. It's been used on many, many space probes because it is a good way of generating long-term heat and energy, particularly when you're getting too far away from the sun to generate enough energy by solar power. Launching them into space is quite hazardous. If you have a failed rocket launch with an RTG on it, then someone's going to have a bad time.
And no, we don't have one in the shed, I'm afraid.
Maybe we should get some more slow brew coffee.
In episode 6, we did have an interview with Andy Weir. There's a little bit of it which we didn't put on that episode. I was emailing Andy Weir about something else, and he said he couldn't do that because he was writing his new book. So I didn't want to interrupt that because I want him to get his new book out. So we've got a little bit of the interview that we didn't put on the last podcast, and it is actually about his new book.
I'm working on my next book now. I have a contract, and it should be out in early 2016. Jack, that Z-H-E-K, the working title. Jack, it's the first time I'm writing a book and not showing it to all of my readers as I write it. It's a more traditional sci-fi. It's softer. It has faster than light travel and aliens and stuff like that. But I'm doing the thing where I said, like, okay, here's how we're going to break the laws of physics. Here's my MacGuffin. Here's the way that they're able to do faster than light travel. And then I'm just like drilling deep into that, just going like, I'm way down the rabbit hole at this point. I've gone so much deeper than any information that would actually be in the book. I mean, going down to like, okay, how do we make sure to preserve like the uncertainty principle across this? And it just goes on and on. It's interesting because once again, it ended up like driving the plot. I found a bunch of things. I'm like, well, wait a minute. If this is how faster than light travel works, then the people who are doing it would need to deal with this problem and then this other problem. And oh, wait, if that's a case, and I've completely made up this aspect of physics that would enable faster than light travel. And then I'm just expanding from that and trying not to break any other rules.
I'm really excited about that. I love that as well, that he's again, because he's a proper nerd, he's gone off researching far beyond what is necessary for the story.
So much stuff depends on C, like the speed of light. It's like the ultimate speed limit of the universe. So changing that can throw everything else off.
Yeah, I think that's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you very much indeed to Maddie and Steve for stepping into the breach left so appallingly by Ben and Laura. Hopefully they'll come back one day, but we'll make do with you guys for now.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for inviting us into the Cosmic Shed.
It's been a dream.
Thank you very much to
Dr. Elliot Sefton-Nash.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon with another podcast. I think we might do Contact. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. For some reason, we have to pretend that there's something we didn't like about
the balance. Yeah. It's like when they put climate change deniers on with equal prominence to climate change proponents.
People who don't like this film are climate deniers.
And moon landing deniers.
Yes.
Buzz.
All of them. We'll set Buzz on.
Gotta give them equal airtime. Melissa Lewis is played by
Jessica Chastain.
Annie Montrose is played by
Kristen Wiig. It's got two eyes. Kristen Wiig.
Mitch Henderson is played by
Sean Bean, who doesn't die.
Woo!
Oh, hashtag spoilers. Sorry about the editing, Ben.